This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's a familiar scenario in Washington. Yet another attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act has come up short, which effectively ends the effort for this fiscal year.
Well, it came down to a handful of Republican senators again, Mark. Senators John McCain and Susan Collins came out against the bill, and it did seem like others were in the queue to vote it down as well. Certainly Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, simply too harmful to too many of her constituents who rely on Medicaid in particular for their health care.
Co-sponsor Senator Lindsey Graham said they're not done trying to repeal the health law. He said they'll be going back at it next year, and they'll deal with tax reform first.
All right. So while the health law remains intact, Mark, still a lot of uncertainty for the marketplace. And states have to grapple with a lot of uncertainty in those insurance markets. And that leads us to our guest today.
Governor Doug Burgum is the Republican governor of the state of North Dakota. He's a longtime tech industry entrepreneur, spearheading a big effort in a state to combat the addiction crisis. Really looking forward to that conversation.
And Lori Robertson will stop by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Governor Doug Burgum in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The latest attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act has come up short again. This time, Senators Susan Collins of Maine and John McCain of Arizona were again deciders against the bill, along with Rand Paul and Ted Cruz for more libertarian reasons. The Congressional Budget Office was able to give the bill a preliminary score this week and confirmed what most health policy analysts already knew, that millions would lose coverage under this bill's version. The bill would also have eliminated funding for Planned Parenthood, which would have impacted health coverage and women's health issues for millions of American women. Senator Orrin Hatch led a hearing in the Senate to discuss the Graham-Cassidy bill this week, and it was a raucous beginning. Hundreds of protesters had lined the halls outside the hearing room. Chants of "kill the bill, don't kill us" reverberating through the hearing room. Some 74 million Americans rely on Medicaid for their health services. Puerto Rico and parts of the U.S. Virgin Islands are on the brink of humanitarian disaster, with much of Puerto Rico, St. Thomas, and St. John without water, electricity, food, or infrastructure. There's also been a very slow trickle of supplies making their way into the islands. There's great difficulty reaching not only the airports, but the hurricane victims cut off in isolation in the island's more rural areas. Hospital ships are being sent to the region to fill immediate health care needs. And 35 million people worldwide are believed to suffer from atrial fibrillation, but many are unaware. AFib is the leading indicator for stroke and heart failure. In a recent study, a technical intervention known as AliveCor was four times more effective in identifying AFib patients than just general care. The smartphone-enabled electrocardiogram allowed clinicians to chart AFib in real-time readings. In a trial of 1,000 participants, 19 asymptomatic cases were picked up using AliveCor versus only 5 in the standard care group. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Doug Burgum, governor of North Dakota. Governor Burgum spent much of his career as a technology entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and philanthropist, founding Great Plains Software in 1983. His successful enterprise was acquired by Microsoft in 2001, where he then served as senior vice president. He founded several other entities, the Kilbourne Group, a real estate firm dedicated to creating smart, healthy cities. In 2009, he was awarded North Dakota's highest honor, the Theodore Roosevelt Rough Rider Award, for his leadership. He earned his undergraduate degree at North Dakota State and his MBA from Stanford University. Governor, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, you know, North Dakota has such significant population growth. But along with that boom in the economy has come some real challenges as well. And when you look at the health landscape in your state, we see a pretty diverse set of populations. You have the influx of workers coming to help with the energy boom, and you have a large sectors of sparsely populated regions, and you as well have a significant Native American population in your state. I wonder if you could share with our listeners your health infrastructure in your state and what some of your biggest healthcare challenges are.
Well, at the highest level, North Dakota, we've got strong competition at the hospital level with multiple large providers. They provided a lot of clinic experiences in the rural areas. Sanford Health, who's the largest employer in the state, just recently completed one of the largest hospital projects in the country. So we do have some very good providers, but as you outlined, literally the landscape of North Dakota, we do have a lot of area where we've got rural areas, and that's where we have some of our challenges. Mm-hmm. And we have four tribal lands in our state, but there's a unique set of challenges in the federal system, the Indian health system on the reservation level, that is, in my mind, fundamentally broken. So we've got an aging population, mm-hmm. and we have to start thinking about how do we evolve our long-term care model to include more home-based care as the technology evolves. So we've also got a lot of assets from which to start from, and I think we have an opportunity, again, partly driven by technology, to address some of the challenges that we're facing.
You know, I'd like to focus just for a moment on one very specific issue that we know, I think you and the First Lady have shown great concern about this, and that's the scourge of the opioid addiction. Could you talk with us a bit about your Recovery Reinvented initiative?
The First Lady was the keynote speaker for the National Recovery Month, and she spoke in Washington, D.C. the day they were releasing the 2016 right. preliminary numbers. 64,000 yep. overdose deaths in the country last year, and it touches every economic level. It touches every state. When we were first inaugurated the next morning, we had an addiction breakfast as part of the inauguration efforts. One of our first days in office, we met some parents, and they came up to the First Lady and I. Had lost their son 2 weeks earlier. Star athlete, had mm-hmm. knee surgery in high mm-hmm. school and had got addicted to opioids. They had no idea about the addiction, and he was found, dead in the car in mm-hmm. the school parking lot. This is not, the 1980s version right. of just say no. And so part of what we're trying to address here is reducing the shame and the stigma. These parents actually said, look, if our son had died of cancer, there would have been fundraisers and vigils. And as it was, because he died of an overdose, then they said, basically no one came over. The shame and the stigma mm-hmm. gets us to not talk about the issue. And 50 years ago, people hid the fact they had cancer. And now if you see a cowboy at a rodeo in North Dakota wearing pink, that he's there as part of the Cancer Awareness Day. So we need to have that same kind of national awareness around addiction. We'll treat addiction like it's an acute disease, and it's not an acute disease. It's chronic, gets progressively worse, and ultimately fatal if not treated. The First Lady, picked addiction as her platform. A reporter asked her why she picked it, and she shared in that interview that she'd been in recovery from alcohol addiction for 15 years, and she herself was someone, and it's very courageous of her to share that, but she had close friends that didn't know that she was in recovery. And so part of Recovery Reinvented is we want to get those that are in recovery out in the open to talk about mm-hmm. that recovery is possible. If you think about the four categories of addiction, if you think about prevention is the first thing we have to do, and that's the most cost effective. Early intervention is the next most cost effective. And then you've got treatment, which is often expensive and sometimes not effective. And then you have recovery on the back end. So we want to focus on all four of those segments, but at least for today, and we've got a large national conference here in Bismarck, North Dakota. We've got people talking about Native American recovery, community-based. And this gets back to your first question, which is in the western half of the state where we've got a sparse population, we don't have the behavioral health providers. The state also has been very, very collaborative with the legislature and with our Department of Corrections and with Human Services and with outside providers, where it costs $41,000 a year to incarcerate someone, and we can put them in treatment for a lot less than that. you know, instead of having mandatory sentences for first-time drug offenses, now we're moving towards presumptive probation. So over the last 25 years, things that used to be misdemeanors became felonies.
Right.
And so then if a person, you know, has an addiction, then also becomes a felon, and then they come out, you know, get a place to live, how do they get a job? And so we're creating additional barriers to their recovery. And in North Dakota, 98.5% of the people get back out of incarceration again. And so as our Leanne Birch, who leads our corrections group, says, you know, hey, we need to be in the business of making better neighbors, not making better prisoners.
Hmm. Yeah. You know, trying to think about the rural nature of North Dakota and your background in technology, wondering how telemedicine is playing into your sort of transformations as you think about reaching people in the rural parts of North Dakota.
Well, one of the things which is great about telemedicine is it reduces distance and, you know, can increase access.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we also need to focus on how do we improve productivity. And if you think of telemedicine as synchronous, you have one patient, you have one provider connected through video connections. And to do that, we have to make sure that we've got a commitment as a state. So we do have an initiative to try to make sure that we've got at least gigabit bandwidth across the entire state. We have to have the best technology infrastructure for moving, you know, data and information, particularly in healthcare. You know, you're talking about a lot of data included in those medical imaging. If it's synchronous, you know, one patient to one doctor, you're reducing the time and the travel, but you're not actually increasing the productivity. And there are some new applications that are coming out that would be considered asynchronous, which is, you know, a person might, you know, answer 20 questions on their phone, then you use artificial intelligence to at least, you know, create a hypothesis, those get queued, and then the provider could be essentially seeing or responding to way more patients in a day than we are right now. And
That's
I
right.
think provider productivity is one of the things that is key to lowering healthcare costs. It's, you know, in all the debate that I hear in Washington, D.C., it's rarely ever discussed.
I wonder if we could talk for a few moments about the Medicaid expansion. In your state has been successful in increasing the number of residents who have health insurance, and certainly we saw that around the country. Obviously, we're all watching as another round of proposed revisions to the Affordable Care Act are presented. I understand that you've said you think there's a better approach to health reform. I wonder if you would share with us your views.
One thing that I think has been missing from the discussion in this in the fall of 2008, when the economy stalled after the financial crisis, there was an $800 billion stimulus bill that the federal government was involved in, and there was $30 billion of that went towards electronic healthcare records, and it was meant to help stimulate the application of electronic healthcare records. And I'm sure at some level people thought, hey, if you apply IT to an industry, it's going to make people more productive. If you read who was getting the subsidies, it was a handful of companies with kind of 1970s style software. And so it became a massive subsidy for those few companies. And it was so complex, the software was difficult, no one was implementing it. So then the government said, hey, well, we've provided the carrot, but no one's putting it in. We need to put the stick. So then they started putting in penalties around the whole category of meaningful use, which if you didn't achieve meaningful use of the electronic healthcare records by certain dates, your reimbursements were knocked down. And so this carrot stick approach sort of quietly destroyed all the competitive economics of IT within healthcare, and it became the thing that consumed everybody's budget. And, you know, I mean, if you add it all up, there's been about $1 trillion of IT spent trying to implement the federally mandated rules around electronic healthcare records. And if you talk to any provider and ask them, how do you feel about your experience the last 4 or 5 years with healthcare records, you're going to get an earful. And it's not about whether they like the software or not. Were they able to see more or less patients than every day? And everyone that I've talked to, and I've talked to a lot, virtually every doctor saw less, in some cases dramatic, because they were spending all of their time with their hands on a keyboard. And then we're taking the thing that we're in scarce short supply of, which is our providers, and we're turning them all into federally mandated data entry individuals. And humans aren't good at data entry.
Right.
And so if you want to have low-cost, high-quality data, it needs to be automatically generated as opposed to human entered. And there's so many ways where we can today, with the kinds of instrumentation that we can have, you can move towards all kinds of automatically generated data, and that will completely change how we think about population health. And if we're not increasing productivity providers, we're never going to see the cost curve come down in healthcare.
We're speaking today with Doug Burgum, governor of North Dakota, technology entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and he's founder of Great Plains Software, which was acquired by Microsoft in 2001. And governor, you've achieved great success in your professional life as a tech entrepreneur, a high-level executive at Microsoft. You also launched some interesting ventures that seek to find innovative ways to positively impact population health and dedicated to creating smart and healthy cities. And I've heard you talk about building walkable, livable cities and building healthy lifestyles. I wonder if you can draw from the experience that you had at the Kilbourne Group to now sitting in the governor's office of how you marry those two together.
Well, our nation spends about $4 trillion on healthcare. So you've got this huge amount of healthcare spend, and often a lot of times we get, you know, they do the comparison of what are we spending on healthcare versus other countries. And if you say, hey, of the $4 trillion, about $1 trillion of that goes towards chronic diseases, you know, that would be heart-related or diabetes-related. And if you say, how do you have less chronic diseases like diabetes and heart? And right away, it's diet and exercise. And so, you know, we do have to look holistically in terms of building healthy cities. We've got to make sure that we're addressing the whole issue of healthy food and the food deserts. And here we are, this tremendous agricultural state. I mean, we lead the nation in over a dozen different crops, but a lot of those crops get sent out of the state for processing and then brought back. So the whole locally grown farm-to-table thing is something we have to have more awareness around. The federal government has really, since post-World War II, been locked in a model where, you know, the one thing that you agree on is we've got to spend more money on infrastructure. But the infrastructure shouldn't be, you know, increasing the breadth of the footprints of our of our cities. You know, Fargo is very flat. The topography is here, quote, the land is cheap on the edge. And so it's very easy for cities to start moving outwards. So when you start building cities around automobiles and not around people, and you have this American idea of single-use zoning, which came from the 1930s when we had dirty industrial areas, well, now you don't have the neighborhood grocery store, the neighborhood coffee shop. Everyone's got to get in their car and drive. And so we just have to take a look at ourselves and say, you know, are we going to build cities for people or are we going to build them for automobiles? And if we build them for people, that's going to lower our healthcare costs because some of the, like the diabetes and heart stuff, it's not about going to the gym for a vigorous workout. It's just about building some walking into your life. And people will walk if there's utility in walking. And we've sort of eliminated the utility. Building a great, healthy, walkable city is simple for us. We have a thing called the Main Street Initiative, which we're doing. It's got three pillars. One is the healthy, vibrant city, which is walkable and has all the things, the arts, the culture, the food that would cause someone to want to live there, because that works into the second pillar, which is workforce development. Because it's with retiring baby boomers, you know, we're facing a chronic workforce shortage. We have a lot of great jobs in North Dakota that are unfilled and open. So we have to build communities that people want to live in. And then the third thing is if you build those livable, walkable communities, you're going to lower your infrastructure costs. Mixed-use density is much more of an efficient model for a taxpayer. It just comes back to helping us break free of the mental model around automobile supremacy.
You know, we've been really struck by some of the examples of collaboration between states that are headed by Democrats or Republicans. And we'd be really interested what your vision is of how states can not only innovate individually, but how they can do this in tandem with others to tackle some of the big problems we've talked about.
Well, as I've gotten to know some of my other governors, I've been really encouraged because governors in particular, you know, we don't have to get up every day and vote along party line. We've got the greatest jobs in the world because every day we can get up and we can say, hey, what we have an opportunity today to make a difference in people's lives. And I think you've talked, virtually every governor is going to feel the same way because we get to work on solving problems. And a lot of these problems require collaboration, both private sector and public sector and, you know, township, city, state level, those levels of collaboration across the different levels of political subdivision. And then that collaboration, I think, is made more and more possible in a future when you've got the technology and the tools that allow for collaboration, they allow for knowledge sharing. And there's a lot of things that large enterprises are using to build collaboration. Because, if you know, it's like at my last job at Microsoft, people working for me in 130 countries, You have to think hard about efficiency. You have to, how do we do something better and cheaper tomorrow than today? And then you look at scale. A state like North Dakota, we're too small to tackle some of these things. And so I think, again, one of the things I like about the block grant approach and getting the 50 states to be platforms of innovation is that you may decide the next step that may come from that is you might pick up the phone and call South Dakota and Wyoming and some other states and, hey, let's have a shared high-risk pool across four states because we need a larger population to have the scale of insurance work. In my mind, it's impossible to come up with a federal solution to healthcare. The rate of change is accelerated because if you think about diseases actually being eliminated, like what the Gates Foundation and others are doing with polio, you know, close to, you know, worldwide eradication, things that's happening with genetics and how we're going to move, you know, on drug therapy to be individualized. I mean, the future is super exciting, but we have to get IT innovation back into healthcare, and one way to do that is to have 50 platforms of innovations. And then, you know, the markets is going to help come up with a lot of solutions that no one can envision today when they're working on these healthcare bills.
We've been speaking today with North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. You can learn more about his work by going to governor.nd.gov, or you can follow him on Twitter at Doug Burgum. Governor, thank you so much for the innovative work you're doing and spending time with us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks, Mark and Margaret.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Once again, we've seen competing claims from Republicans and Democrats on whether the latest GOP effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act continues to protect those with pre-existing medical conditions. Under the Graham-Cassidy bill, insurers couldn't refuse to sell policies, but they could price plans based on health status in states that allowed it. Senator Bill Cassidy, a sponsor of the latest bill, said on CNN that the, quote, protection is absolutely the same as under the ACA. It isn't. The Graham-Cassidy legislation would eliminate the Affordable Care Act's premium tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies for low-income people buying coverage on the individual market, as well as federal funding for the expansion of Medicaid, and instead provide block grants to states. States must submit applications explaining how they would spend the block grant funds. A state could waive the ACA's ban on pricing insurance policies based on health status. The legislation says a state would have to describe how it would, quote, maintain access to adequate and affordable health insurance coverage for individuals with pre-existing conditions. States could allow insurers to vary premiums, including on the basis of health status, but not on the basis of gender, race, or religion. And even with the provisions that could be waived under the ACA, like the law's requirements that health plans cover 10 essential health benefits, states would have to show that coverage would still be as comprehensive and as affordable and ensure at least a comparable number of people as would have occurred without the waiver. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Currently, about 2 million people around the world are suffering from end-stage renal disease. There are basically two options for these patients: kidney transplants, which are severely lacking in available donor kidneys, or dialysis, also costly as well as time-consuming, requiring patients to undergo blood filtering treatments at medical facilities, lasting up to 5 hours per treatment, costing about $90,000 per year. A Montreal teen science project just may pave the way for another solution. Anya Pagarian developed a portable home dialysis kit that cost about $500 to produce.
It's not necessarily easy to go 3 times a week to the hospital. especially if you have maybe limited mobility.
Pogarian says hundreds of hours of research led her to build a prototype of the dialysis machine, which is about the size of a typical game board, but pumps and purifies blood just as large-scale dialysis machines do. Her invention has earned her numerous awards and scholarships. She hopes this device can be developed throughout the world, especially third world countries.
10% of patients living in India and Pakistan who need the treatment cannot afford it or it's not accessible. So that's really what motivated me to continue.
A relatively cheap, portable, easily assembled dialysis machine that could alleviate the cost and treatment hurdles of ongoing dialysis, keeping patients healthier longer. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.